This episode of Literary Treks is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading, in case I got bored.
Welcome everyone to another episode of Literary Treks, our dedicated Star Trek books and comics show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me once again this week, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, how is everything going this week?
Well, Chris, it's going pretty well here in Dallas. It's a little bit warmer now. We are in almost the end of April. We are in the end of April, Chris. Let's just be honest. And so that means it starts to warm up here. But we had a fantastic Easter, I was really had a great time. Had some great time off, family and friends. So. Not too much to complain about. That makes a 4-day work week. So it's already hump day.
That would be nice.
It is very exciting. How about you, Chris?
Oh, it's busy, busy, busy as always. 4-day work week. What is that? I do 7-day work weeks myself. That's just how I roll. Well,
that is true. You are a much harder worker than I am, Chris. So I'm not even going to pretend like that's not the case.
Oh, but I have children, Matthew. That's, you know.
This is true. I do not have any kids. I only have nieces and nephews now. And, well, the lucky thing is I just get to give them back. So, they're not around all the time.
Well, let's go ahead and jump into the show because we have quite a bit of news today. And then in the feature, we're going to talk about an older novel, Peter David's The Captain's Daughter, as part of our preparation for One Constant Star, which will be coming up soon. And in news, the first item that we have is about one of my favorite things, the Star Trek Ships of the Line calendar. I buy the Ships of the Line calendar every single year, and I have for years. And one of the joys for me of doing Trek FM over the past few years is being able to actually get to know people like Doug Drexler who work on this calendar and design these ships.
Chris, I have to say, you know, the Ships of the Line calendar and the artwork that these guys do is really inspired, I think. It's such beautiful work. I mean, they're putting painstaking detail into our favorite starships. Starships we've always wanted to see before. I mean, it's where we first got a look at the Aventine. Things mm-hmm. like that that you'd never seen before, you really wanted to see. And so I really do love when this calendar comes out. And this was really exciting to me, Chris, because, you know, they put that book out, the Ships of the Line book, that had the collected of all the different artwork, all the different artwork they'd done.
Right.
And so they decided that, you know, that was 2006. So it's mm-hmm. 2014 now, and they've decided that they need to do a new edition, which for me is awesome. One, I don't have the original Ships of the Line book, and so this book is not only going to boast the original artwork from the original book, it's also going to have 75 brand new spanking images in it, and that is really exciting.
That's really cool. So that's good to hear that it's not going to be a second volume, but it's actually going to be an updated edition with all of these new ships. And I understand it's also going to have new text by Mike Okuda.
Which is fantastic. You know, Mike does such a great job of giving you great background text on whatever ship it is that you're looking at. And as we know, too, I mean, with the Ships of the Line calendar, there's a lot of ships in there that not even every Star Trek fan is immediately going to recognize. And so having his text there, I think is going to be really great. And plus, Chris, the price of this, only $30. You know, so I'm hoping it's a great I would actually like it to be a little bit bigger than the last one, personally.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Kind of maybe a little bit more coffee table size, but who knows? And looks like October 28th will be the drop date for that. So I'm pretty sure this is going to be a big deal. In fact, StarTrek.com did a whole write-up about this as well. You can even go take a look at in the show notes. So it looks beautiful. I mean, even the artwork they used there to promo this is really fantastic stuff.
Yeah, it's great. We should point out that for $30, that is getting you a hardcover book, not a paperback, you know, not a paperback reference book, but an actual full-on hardcover book. Now, it's also going to be available as an ebook, but this is one of those books that you really want the physical hardcover. I don't think an ebook would cut it for me on this.
The only thing, Chris, that I was thinking with the ebook is those pictures. You do a nice screenshot.
And oh, that's
a beautiful wallpaper,
yeah.
You know, for your iPad. And on that Retina display, it would just look fantastic. So
right.
I can see myself being tempted, you know, to get that. But I'm with you. I would much rather have this as a great book just to be able to take out and kind of peruse every once in a while and just really enjoy the great work that these artists do. And so I'm really looking forward to this. I was really excited to see this.
Matthew, I think what you mean is that we can both see ourselves being tempted to buy both. So it would be $60 for us, hardcover and the ebook, so that we can create wallpaper for our iPads and iPhones.
This is true. now, oh, Pocket is just right now going, excellent.
That's
just
right.
Mr. Burns from The Simpsons. But, you know, luckily, though, too, usually the ebook is not as expensive. So you probably wouldn't be paying a full $60 for this. So that is one of the things that would kind of make it tempting. If it was like a $15 ebook, it's much more tempting to kind of get that, you know, especially if you get a nice Amazon gift card from somebody or an iBooks gift card or something like that. So no reason to not be picking this up, as a fan. And I think too, for me, Chris, the main reason is really to support the work that these artists have been doing. And to show that there's a real validity to continuing this kind of work for Star Trek.
Most definitely. I'm really glad to see they're doing this as well. So let's go on to the next story. And this one, Matthew, I was surprised to see you put this in the outline here because I thought we were a show about books and comics. This is called Star Trek Pop-Ups. Now, weren't those the popsicles that the ice cream truck brought? And you push the stick up and you can lick Kirk, Spock, and McCoy?
I'm just going to let some of the things go there, Chris. And yes, when I saw this, I actually did think of those, you know, those things were so good. But no, okay. I don't know if anybody knows this, but I worked for Barnes & Noble for about 3 years and ran the kids department. And I have a huge affinity for great pop-up art. And I mean children's pop-up books. And I have some really cool ones. In fact, I have one by Robert Sabuda, who is one of the most famous pop-up artists out there, his Peter Pan that he did, and it's signed. So I was really excited when they decided that they were going to be giving us a Star Trek pop-up book. Now, they've had these for Star Wars, and they have been fantastic. So the thought of having a Star Trek pop-up book that I can give to my niece and nephew and show them, you know, not only the movie era Enterprise, which is on the cover, which obviously we've talked about, the best Enterprise there is. I'm sorry to anyone else who doesn't agree. If you want to talk about beautiful nacelles, those are high quality nacelles. But Chris, also going to be getting things like Borg Cube, Klingon ships, even Captain Proton is going to be in there. So Dayton Ward is going to be super excited to get a copy of this.
Oh, definitely. They should have Dayton writing the Captain Proton book. Now, these books are going to be written by Paula M. Block and Terry J. Erdman, who have given us some fantastic reference books, as well as some other books as well for Star Trek. In fact, they have that really clever one coming up, right, about Vulcan Love Slave Part 2. I believe.
Oh, yes,
is what
and
it's about,
Quark
right?
And his pursuit of his brand new holo program. Yeah,
right.
Exactly. That's Lust Latinum and something else. So that's yeah, right. It's going to be fantastic.
Lust Latinum and Loss, I think it is. But
yes, Lust Latinum and Loss. There we go.
So they're going to be writing this, but they should have Dayton writing the Captain Proton one. That would be awesome.
That would be
at
really,
least the
really
Captain
really
Proton
funny.
Page. it's great that they're doing this because, like you said, they have had them for Star Wars, and I'm hopeful. Although, you know, I'm always hopeful over the years, and it never quite seems to catch on to the extent that it should. But I'm hopeful that maybe they're starting to market Star Trek in the way Star Wars has been marketed to really reach a new audience, because it's important to get, for the health of the franchise, to get kids interested in Star Trek. What is Star Trek? And, you know, and they can be into it for the pop-ups and the ships and everything when they're young. And then, like we do, you know, find new things in it as they get older. We just don't get enough of this kind of stuff for Star Trek. So this is really, really good to see.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Chris. I mean, we got the Star Trek Visual Dictionary last mm-hmm. year, which I thought was great. We both talked about how that's a great way to introduce your kids to Star Trek, as well as getting the Aboard the Enterprise D book that came out with the beautiful layouts that came with the CD-ROM and everything, perfect for kids as well. I think this is genius move. One, you know, really good pop-up art is a lot of fun. And it's really, if it's really well done, it's actually really beautiful too. I think that my guess is they've seen what, was done with the Star Wars books and they're thinking we can do this with Star Trek too. So I'm excited. And it looks like this is going to be right around the time that you'll be wanting to buy those Christmas gifts because it's coming up in November. So this is something I think every Star Trek fan should have under the Christmas tree.
Coming up in November, huh? I think they're actually just putting it out for my birthday, since that is in November.
Yeah, that's probably it, Chris.
They know that I wanted a pop-up book, yeah.
Yeah, you just wanted a Star Trek pop-up. I mean, you can't lick this one, Chris. There's no ice cream. It's just a book. So, and you can't really judge a book by its taste. So,
oh, God.
Yeah.
I'm not doing any sound effects for judge a book by its taste, Matthew.
Oh, that's too bad. I thought I was going to get a new sound effect.
All right. Well, let's go to the next story. Now, the next one here, I shared my thoughts on this on the Ready Room this past week. We don't talk about books and comics on the Ready Room very often, but this one I just couldn't resist, and especially since I had Darren from Earl Grey as my co-host, I wanted to know what he thought about it. And now I want to know what you think about it. IDW, coming in July, is going to begin a 6-part galaxy-spanning adventure called The Q Gambit, which is going to bring Q into the Abramsverse.
Chris, first thought was, do we have to bring Q into everything? Second thought was, this could be a lot of fun. Mainly because we've never seen Q meet Kirk. So it really is a different dynamic. You know, you're getting something we have never seen. It makes sense to me that Q could span, you know, different realities in space and time because he's all powerful and he doesn't really exist in a certain time anyway. So I have no problem with that. I actually really like the idea that the Q themselves as beings are unchanged in every single universe. Like mm-hmm. they exist in all different multiverses. You know, I think that's a great idea. It makes them even more interesting and powerful. So I think, and I'm going to hold out hope that this is going to be fantastic because I would really like it to be. And I think it could just be a really interesting time, especially seeing Kirk, Spock, and McCoy and all these kind of characters deal with Q, especially as we've kind of watched this Kirk and this Spock and this JJ verse really kind of slowly mature more into those characters we're used to. And, because of that, I think it's going to make for a really interesting series. So, and I'm, you know, I don't want to judge something before I've read it. And so the idea sounds sound to me. And, you know, if it sucks after I read it, you know, that's fine. But I'm going to hold out hope that this is actually going to be really cool.
And when you say if it sucks, you mean S-U-Q-S, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Because we were thinking about the title. It's the Q Gambit. And we thought that's just kind of not like the normal way they would do it. Maybe it should be the Cambit. Q-A-M-B-I-T.
That's true. You could do that. It might be something, you know, they're probably thinking, you know, booksellers and trying to sell this book and people like, how do you spell Quambit? Quimbit? Quambit?
They won't know what it is.
Yeah, exactly. So they're probably, I mean, they probably heard your idea and thought, oh, that's a good one. And then they realized this is going to be hard for people to try and figure out, you know, like, if they're at their Barnes & Noble and they're trying to find the book on the shelf, and once it's, you know, completely put together as a trade paperback. And I'm sorry, do you have that Q, that Star Trek, you know, comic book, the Quambit, that, and then, you know, the person's just looking at them like they're crazy?
Yeah. Well, Mike Johnson, who... anyone listening to the show knows oversees the writing of the Star Trek Ongoing series for IDW. This is what he had to say about it. He said, part of the fun of the new Star Trek movie franchise is seeing how beloved characters are different in the new timeline, but one iconic adversary remains unchanged, Q. His fascination with humanity and his penchant for mischief remain the same across the multiverse, and now he's come to take the Enterprise crew on an adventure that will bring new meaning to the phrase no-win scenario. So just what you were talking about, Matthew, they remain unchanged. I have a question for you here. This is kind of what I'm thinking is going to happen. At the end of the press release about it, it says that under license by CBS Consumer Products, the Q Gambit begins when the mischievous Q sends James T. Kirk on a quest that will see the Enterprise joining forces with familiar faces from Star Trek lore, beginning with the crew of a certain space station. So it's either Abrams verse Deep Space Nine, or what I think may be more likely, timeline crossover, Prime Universe DS9, Abrams verse TOS era Enterprise crew. I don't know.
Well, and doesn't that Abrams verse TOS Enterprise just dwarf the Deep Space Nine itself?
Oh, it might. I mean, it is a huge,
like,
ship,
it's
isn't
ginormous. I mean, like, the size of that sucker, it's huge, like a watermelon and toothpick.
Just think about how excited Quark will be, though, to have an unlimited supply of Budweiser to serve.
This is true. Well, you know, is Budweiser Classic, though, really big on DS9?
Well, not yet, but after Quark.
After Kirk visits.
Yeah,
I can see that, yeah. The fact that they're going to be facing a familiar phone, it sounds like the Dominion somehow. And I would love to see, you know, this on the JJ verse DS9, actually. Because we already saw, you know, Mudd's daughter is half Bajoran.
That's a really good point, yeah.
So that may, you know, we kind of talked about that. We're like, what does this mean? And so that could be something where maybe Mudd will actually play a part now in this. And so they've kind of been setting that all up. And, so I'm thinking that could be just something that's really, really interesting.
Yeah.
Then kind of tying some of the things that they have kind of thrown in there and putting it all together.
Now, of course, we have to deal with the fact that we're talking about two different centuries here. But, of course, Q can easily transport the Enterprise to the 24th century. I don't know. We're speculating. We have no idea what the story is. But, yeah, I love the point about Mudd's daughter being half Bajoran, because I do remember when we saw that, and we thought, you know, they could just be doing this to be cute and like throwing a Bajoran, but probably there's something more to it, and maybe they're finally going to pick that up somehow.
Yeah, I think it would be just fantastic. And You know, it makes it kind of interesting because, you know, a familiar space station, you know, are we really just compressing the timeline here so that somebody like Sisko exists in the same kind of era as Kirk and all of that? I'm all for it, whatever, right? You know, it's the JJ verse. We're supposed to be able to do whatever we want. Yeah. So,
unless they're talking about the Regulus station and they're just going to drop Carol Marcus off there so she can start working on the Abrams first Genesis torpedo.
Yes. goodness. Gosh, Chris, we could do just about anything. But again, I mean, I think that this is kind of an interesting thing. You know, so Q in the original TNG, they meet the Borg, one of the Federation's greatest adversaries. And, you know, with them, you know, being on the station, it'd be interesting if Q introduces this crew to Dominion. And mm-hmm. because that's another one of the Federation's greatest adversaries. I mean, so, be very, very interesting to see exactly how this all plays out.
Yeah, it will be indeed. So we will see. And also coming, coincidentally, in July is the Star Trek Medical Officers special, which I suppose you are probably thinking in your mind is simply the Beverly Crusher book, right?
Well, Chris, if you've seen the cover, Beverly is prominently featured, as she should be, on everything. And so, well done, this cover designer. Well done. You have my stamp of sufficiently exciting cover. But yes, this is what's really exciting to me, because I like the Doctors of Star Trek. I've always enjoyed them. And so it's going to be interesting. We're going to be getting the EMH, Beverly Crusher, Bashir, Pulaski, with some help from Leonard McCoy and Phlox, all joining forces against time to find a cure for this deadly metamorphic disease. And so it sounds really cool. I don't know how they're all going to meet. I guess the holodeck might be involved.
I don't know.
Or some sort of crazy time travel. Who knows? But yeah. I think this will be really exciting.
Well, it's the kind of thing you can do in comics and you can kind of shrug it off and say, okay, yeah, whatever. Like if this were a novel, it might be a bit of a stretch for me to think about all of these doctors all coming together to solve one problem, especially if they actually are all together. Like if there's one room and they're all sitting around having a staff meeting, a medical staff meeting about this problem, it's going to be kind of weird.
Yeah. The only point here, Chris, that I'm really disturbed by is why is Pulaski involved? Who cares about right? Pulaski? I mean, what is she doing there? Is she there just to make fun of Data, or is she going to call Bashir some sort of, you know, freakish automaton because he's genetically enhanced?
She's there to make sure that no one gets too excited, you know, no one has too much fun. If the mood of the meeting starts to rise a little bit, she's there to bring it down.
Oh, I thought that's what the EMH was for.
No, he'll make some, you know, he's there to make humorous quips about everything that's going on.
Yes,
now,
that's true.
Phlox, he'll be over there at the end of the table clipping his toenails. And then, you know, he'll suggest...
Cleaning his tongue.
And then he will suggest incorporating a bat into every solution.
Which, strangely enough, makes him just sound like Batman. I'm Batman.
You're just looking for an excuse to do a Batman voice on the show, Matthew.
Exactly. I really, really was. But it made me think of, when you're like, he's going to, you know, it just made me think of the terribleness of Batman and Robin, where everything was bat something. Yeah. And Bruce Wayne, dressed as Batman, literally pulls out his bat card. It's a credit card that says bat card on it. So, you know, I'm just thinking about Phlox having bats for everything. You're going to want a bat with that.
Oh, goodness. All right. Would you like a bat with that? I can see Phlox. Like Phlox, he gets drummed out of Starfleet and he has to start working.
He's working at like a zoo or something.
No, he's working at like a space McDonald's. and the drive-through
for Klingons.
He's like, "Would you like a bout with that?"
They're only 50 cents extra.
Oh goodness! All right. Okay, well, back to the actual story here. Another interesting twist to this is that they're teaming up with the Calcom Tricorder X Prize, which we've talked about on the Ready Room before, I know, at some point in the past. But it's a global competition in which 30 teams are competing to develop a consumer-friendly mobile device capable of diagnosing and interpreting a set of health conditions and vital health metrics. And of course, it's inspired by the Star Trek Tricorder. And I love the fact, now, of course, you know, they had the X Prize for commercial spaceflight, right, to develop ships for the private sector. And that was a great success. I love the fact that they're doing this for a tricorder, because this is something that, if there's something behind it pushing the development like this, I think within the decade, we'll probably actually see something that resembles a Star Trek tricorder, because there are already add-ons for smartphones that do a lot of the things that a tricorder does.
I'm with you, Chris. I think this is great. It's one of the things that's made me so sad about the space program here in the States, you know, basically being non-existent these days.
Yeah.
And how much that helped fuel all the technology that we use now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know that the private industry does a great job, but, you know, there's just something about the way that NASA researched that gave us so much. I feel like we're losing out on some great discoveries. And so I'm glad at least somebody is taking this mantle and running with it.
Yeah.
Trying to get us towards a better and brighter future in this way. So it's
definitely
good to see.
And the connection here with the Tricorder X Prize and this comic here, the Starfleet Medical Officers special, which is actually called Flesh and Stone, and is written by Scott and David Tipton, who, of course, are two of the great Star Trek comic writers, is that the Tricorder, you know, has inspired this particular story, which centers around that technology. And yeah, I think it's just a great way to promote Star Trek and promote this technological advancement at the same time.
Definitely. And, you know, it was interesting. They said that when IDW came to them, you know, how could they say no to something so mm-hmm. brilliant? The idea of teaming up all these doctors for the very first time. So that we would see this. I think that's pretty exciting as well. So as long as Beverly is front and center on all the covers, I'm going to be a huge fan.
That's all you're worried about, yeah. Well, that's all we have in news today, Matthew. Before we jump into the feature where we're going to talk about Peter David's The Captain's Daughter, let's tell everyone about our sponsor for today's show, Audible.com. Now, Audible is the best source for audiobooks that you're going to find online anywhere. They have over 150,000 titles waiting for you right now. They add hundreds of new titles every week. And of course, each week we tell you how great Audible is. But what we also like to do is to recommend a book. And today, Matthew, I thought, since we're going to be talking about one of Peter David's books in the future, I thought we would recommend another of Peter David's Star Trek books, and actually four of them. And these are the original four Star Trek New Frontier books. They're available together in sort of an omnibus, and they're narrated by Joe Morton. And it's a really great way to get into this series if you've never read it before. Of course, there's Captain Mackenzie Calhoun. Shelby is there as his first officer from The Best of Both Worlds. And of course, for me, you know, Robin Loeffler is also a member of the Excalibur crew.
I don't think she's on the cover, though, Chris, which is disappointing for you.
It's a major oversight.
Isn't Shelby the one that's on the cover of one of the books?
Yeah. Well, now, actually, Loeffler is on the cover of one of the books, but she's kind of off in the back behind Calhoun as the captain. Oh. You know, he gets to be front and center. La, 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 la. So what? You're a captain. Come on. Robin Loeffler's behind you. She should be on every cover.
That's, yeah. I mean, starting to sound like a Maxim magazine instead of a Star Trek book.
I guess so. But I remember when these books came out, and I actually got the paperbacks when they first came out. You know, they were fairly short, the first four entries, and then it went into a proper novel series. But it was a fine way to get into the story, actually, by having these four shorter books that took you through. And for those who don't know about New Frontier, the basis of it is that it's a new ship, a new crew, and a new mission. And Peter David put this crew together, and I kind of remember at the time it was sort of a new thing. You know, we've had other series since then where we've had other ships and we've had other crews, but this was kind of a new thing back in the mid-90s when this came out. Star Trek New Frontier, originally an Ambassador-class starship, the Excalibur. Eventually, the Excalibur does get replaced with a Galaxy-class ship as you go through the series of books. And in the first one, they're being sent to Sector 221-G, which was once ruled by the vicious Thelonians. And, you know, things have descended into chaos. Captain Calhoun and his crew, they must go there. They must help work things out, kind of smooth over these old hatreds that are resurfacing. There are petty tyrants with deadly weapons, and, you know, they have to just stop various worlds from falling into self-destruction. So it's, if you're looking for new adventures in the Star Trek universe that go beyond the familiar characters, but you still want those connections, like I mentioned, Shelby, Robin Loeffler, this is a great way to get into it. And you can get it in audio format. And best of all, as a Trek FM listener, you can get it absolutely free just for trying Audible. What you do is you go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up. Choose Peter David's New Frontier, books 1-4, which is a single title, and you can get that free. If at the end of the trial period you decide Audible's not for you, you have nothing to lose because you get to keep that book. But you're going to love Audible. If you love podcasts, you're going to love audiobooks. If you're already getting them from another source, Audible is, believe me, the best place to get them. I've been getting mine there for 14 years. No plans to stop anytime soon. And remember, too, you know, if you don't want to get New Frontier, you can actually choose any book on Audible absolutely free for trying Audible. So go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. And we really thank Audible for their support of the show and the network. And, of course, we thank you for supporting Audible.
Well, Chris, in a few short weeks, and not too long from now, we're going to be having David R. George III's One Constant Star coming out, filling in some of the Lost era for us with the Enterprise B and her captain, John Harriman, and Demora Sulu. And so I thought it would be really interesting to kind of go back to some of the books that have used these characters and kind of see the backstory that has played out for them. And so the first book that we're going to be talking about while we're kind of do this retrospective getting ready for the book is The Captain's Daughter, which is by Peter David. And it was released back in December, actually, of 1995. It's crazy to think that it's been that long ago.
It really is, yeah.
And so, and this book actually, too, was a part of the original series, numbered series. And this was number 76. That's, again, how long ago this was for this book. It is a story of Demora Sulu, a young Starfleet officer who suddenly attacks her commanding officer, Captain Harriman, and kills her in self-defense. And so Hikaru Sulu, captain of the Excelsior, really wants to determine the truth behind what happened to his daughter. All while doing that, Peter David does give us the backstory for something that we saw in Generations that we all kind of scratched our heads at, which was Sulu had a daughter?
Huh? Right.
And so Peter David does, I think, what can only be described as a pretty masterful job of weaving the story of Sulu having a daughter and how that happened. And so one of the things that we'll talk about, if we feel like it kind of fits well enough with what we got in Generations, and making mm-hmm. sense of that. So Chris, one, you know, we both have been through The Captain's Daughter, just kind of first impressions, after reading it.
Well, before I give you my first impressions, I do want to give everyone our spoiler alert that we are going to
Danger, Will Robinson, danger.
We are going to talk about the book and what happens in the book. This is a 19-year-old book, so hopefully if you haven't read it yet and you plan to read it and you'd like to do that before you listen to the episode, you might want to do that.
If you haven't read it yet, Lottie, I kind of help you.
So just so you know, we are going to talk about what happens here in the book because there are a number of twists in this story. So first impressions, I thought this was a really good book. Like you said, I think Peter David did a masterful job in this book of filling in the blanks. And right off the bat, well, not right off the bat because it's not the very first thing we learn. I just love the fact that we actually find out why her name is Demora. And I thought the reason her name is Demora was really cool and really clever. Now, right off the bat, I thought that maybe this was a story about Counselor Troy because it starts out with some chocolate mousse.
It does. I thought that it was very funny that apparently Demora Sulu is as much a chocoholic as Counselor Troy is. And so good to know that chocoholism runs deep in Starfleet.
It really does. You know, you talk about how a novel needs to have a great opening to hook you in. And this novel has a great opening. The very first sentence in the book is, "If Demora Sulu had known her funeral would be in a week, she would have had the chocolate mousse."
Which is I think a trait that I noticed throughout the book that David likes to do. He likes to tell you what's going to happen and then fill in the story, because he does that a couple of times in the story. And it's a fun, like, kind of like a literary device to kind of give you an idea that, you know, this is going to happen. Yeah. And this is how we get there.
But he doesn't really tell you what's going to happen. He just hints. You know, there's the other moment where if Harriman knew that Chekhov was going to slug him. But it takes you a long time before you get to that moment where that happens.
Right. Exactly. What I thought was really interesting, it's interesting in this first section, the book is actually broken up into five different sections, so that's kind of how we're going to talk about them. So the first section is called Death, and it's really going to deal with how this happens to Demora to set up the rest of the story. But as much as they, you know, he does to really set up Demora, I felt like this first section belongs as much to Harriman as well, and his struggle. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll say this: we have seen a lot since Generations came out, you know, in 94, kind of about Harriman. So you take that back and rewind, this is probably one of the first things that we ever saw literature-wise. So I was trying to kind of put my mindset there.
It's hard,
instead
right?
of here where I've kind of seen, you know, that kind of stuff.
It's difficult to do that. But
yeah,
I think you're
really
right.
Is.
Like the title of the section is Death. And I think it's two things. It is the death of Demora, but it's the death of Harriman as well. I mean, he doesn't physically die, but it's like his whole spirit and everything that makes him a person and makes him a captain died when Captain Kirk was lost under his watch.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's this great line of what he's thinking of. And he says, he's talking about Kirk and thinking about Kirk. And he says, "Now I get to be known as the captain whose first mission destroyed the indestructible Kirk, the man who had survived 1,000 dangers until he found the one thing he couldn't overcome, the command of Captain John Harriman." And the idea that he feels like his crew, you know, refers to him as the Flying Dutchman.
Yeah.
You know, just a terrible omen for any sailor, or sailor of the stars as well. And I really like this. I love kind of getting into this guy's head, because you can tell that he wants to be something different. He wants to live actually into the legend of somebody like a Kirk, you know, that's where he would like to be. And he feels like, I think in some ways his dream has been crushed of that ever happening, because the only thing he'll ever be remembered for is the guy who took the starship out that wasn't quite ready, because Starfleet rammed that idea down his throat and he couldn't save Kirk.
And that's what we get in here as well, is that Starfleet wanted him to go do this, because we don't get that in the movie, right? In the movie, we just get that, oh, yeah, the Enterprise B is going to go and do a little run around the solar system. And man, it's not a big deal that the ship's not ready, because we're not really going to go anywhere, right? And we don't really get the feeling that Harriman is resistant to this idea in the movie, but the book here actually adds a lot more depth to what was going on for him during the events surrounding that little flight that resulted in the loss of Kirk.
Well, and it makes so much more sense, I think, to add some depth to this character, but just the storyline itself that, I mean, no captain would want to take their ship out half-assed. I mean, that's really what happens to the poor guy. Well, and it's not really...
Captain Homer Simpson of the USS Half-Assed.
Well, that's very true. you know, luckily he doesn't ever leave the star system or the planet, because he can never get off planet. But I just, you know, it makes so much more sense, and it really kind of creates the beginning of this tension that Starfleet is feeling with this transition from this kind of these legendary figures to a new generation. I don't say the next generation, a new generation, which I think is something we're going to probably talk about maybe a little bit later, Chris, but I didn't quite... At least from the one admiral's point of view, Harriman's dad, to be exact,
yeah,
I felt was, it didn't make sense to me. And maybe it was more, there's some sort of jealousy between Harriman's dad. They call him Blackjack.
Yeah.
And so then there actually was the reality of this kind of like, I mean, maybe Kirk just slept with this woman or something, or Chekhov, you know, as you guys talked about on the Ready Room the other week, you know.
Well,
Chekhov has a reputation of a ladies' man.
Yeah.
You
know,
so
I don't know. I wasn't crazy about the character of Blackjack Harriman here either, who we find out.
He's just a classic badmiral.
He is a classic badmiral. And we find out that his name isn't actually Jack. His name is John. He's John Harriman Sr. And Captain Harriman that we know is John Harriman Jr. They call him Blackjack because he was a legendary card player at the Academy. I wasn't crazy about the character really, because it's one of those things where at the end of the book, we end up basically with a high-stakes game of poker between the Enterprise B and the Excelsior. And, of course, the guy calling the shots is Blackjack Harriman, who's an expert at playing cards. And he was actually on his way to a conference where he was going to actually have to play cards against somebody, which I thought was kind of corny as well. But what I did get from him, though, is you talk about maybe a little bit of jealousy there, but I also saw him as representing sort of the old guard. You know, Starfleet is changing. One thing that's interesting in this book is that we start to see how Starfleet is still, even in the 23rd century, developing its framework of operations. You know, recently we've talked about Rise of the Federation, the Enterprise books, where we're seeing the Federation start to come together and Starfleet begin forming. And they haven't yet worked out things like the Prime Directive and how everything's going to work together. And what we see in here is the events that bridge Kirk's time, where the captain always goes on the away mission, and Picard's time, where the first officer goes down and the captain's supposed to stay on the ship and be safe. And so I see Admiral Harriman here as also representing sort of that old guard that's very grumpy and sort of like, you know, the get off my lawn guy to these younger Starfleet officers, and his son, Captain Harriman, is one of those, is part of that generation, but Captain Kirk and Chekhov and Sulu and all these guys are the ones who really represent what he sees as sort of the problem with Starfleet.
Yeah, it did really create an interesting idea that that somebody wouldn't see Kirk as a hero, and that that crew is a hero. Whereas the opposite side, which is really interesting when we get to when Janice Rand enters, when she's taking care of D'Amore. We're just jumping around all over the place at this point. But it's an important conversation for the book. That she talks about, you know, if the Enterprise, if you needed something done, you called the Enterprise, and we all knew it. We were the best ship, we were the best crew that any captain ever had, as Captain Sisko would say. But you know, Kirk would say the same about his crew. They were the best ship, they were the best crew, and if you did need something done, if something came up, you wanted the Enterprise on the front lines because you knew somehow, some way, Kirk was going to pull a magical solution out of his butt and you were going to be fine. And what I really just got from the Blackjack character was, I think it was more to me, this insane jealousy of that he wasn't that person.
Yeah.
And that's why, because he was the kind of person whose authority was being usurped by somebody like Kirk, who maybe just had the better ideas, you know, he was the one who was out there making things happen. Whereas he's the guy at the back, just not making history, basically.
When he first showed up on the ship, when he first showed up on the Enterprise B and he walked in, and this is when we find out that he is Captain Harriman's father. He seemed like he was there to be sort of the, at least he seemed like a caring father at that first time, right? Because Harriman is down on himself, and he tells, one of the first things he tells his father is, I'm afraid I'm being regarded as something of a jinx. And his father says that, you know, these things happen. And he says, but what's giving this thing its subtext is the Kirk connection. And then we get to what we've been talking about here with how he perceives Kirk. And he says, I'm telling you right now, and I can say this as an admiral, not as your father, that you're 10 times the officer Kirk ever was. Kirk was a cowboy, a troublemaker, thought he owned the galaxy, thought he had all the answers, second-guessed regs all the time, did what he felt like doing, and managed to come up smelling like a rose because he had admirers in the right places. And actually, that, I think, plays to what you say, that he did feel that his power was being usurped by Kirk, and being an admiral, he didn't like that. But to say Harriman is 10 times the officer Kirk ever was, I shook my head when I read that. I don't know about that.
Yeah. Well, and I, that was where I just knew, and that's where I began to get that kind of sense of jealousy that Blackjack seems to have. Whereas Harriman, John Harriman, doesn't have any of that. You know, I think for him, the thought of being Kirk is what drives him. Being somebody like Kirk is what drives him. I think he still sees him as a model, you know, officer, soldier, negotiator, all of those things. That's what he sees himself as wanting to be. He just doesn't know he's going to get there. And so I think that was really fantastic. And of course, they are on a mission. They go to this planet, the Enterprise B. And they are on an away mission, which Harriman decides to lead, even though he has the conversation in his head with the idea that he's not really supposed to be leading them, but it's still, at this point, the captain's prerogative, and he, of course, takes it. And they can't figure out what's going on, and the next thing they know, they're being attacked by a deranged, naked D'Amora Sulu who looks like a rabid animal.
Yeah.
And who literally beats the crap out of Harriman.
Well,
and his only recourse is to kill her.
Is to kill her, yeah. Now, before we get to that point, though, one thing that's also interesting in this first section here, even though it's titled Death, is that we get to know a little bit about D'Amora. Because basically, what we saw her in Generations, and we knew that she was Sulu's daughter, but not much else, right? So it was really nice to get some background. I think Peter David did a good job here of making us feel some connection to her before the events that you just mentioned, where Harriman actually has to shoot her. And they also lure her down to, well, this planet. They receive a distress signal, and it's in Chinese, like a dialect of Chinese, which was kind of weird, and that kind of enticed her to want to go on the away mission in the first place. And part of it was that we find her as sort of a dreamer, like wanting to follow in the footsteps of her father because she's heard all these adventures. And at this point in the book, we don't yet know the whole backstory of how she was born, you know, and how she came together with her father in the first place. And so it's interesting up front of her, you know, like I got the feeling that like she wanted to go back to, this is what I wrote down in my notes. And I don't know if I felt this way as the story went on, but just initially, when she talks about all the stories that her father's told her about, you know, the Wonderland planet and the White Rabbit and all these different things that he experienced, I almost felt like the years of Kirk's first 5-year mission was like the childhood for Star Trek. And then D'Mara is living in another time, and like she wants to go back to that childhood and she can't. And maybe it does connect a little bit, actually, if I think about it, what we learn in the next sections of the book about her actual childhood and maybe the things that she missed out on is something I think she was trying to seek all the time.
Yeah, I definitely see that. I really, it actually even plays into some of the things, you know. It's funny because she mentions that amusement planet and it gets mentioned again, and then it's used mm-hmm. as a catalyst for actually the whole basis of the protagonists and their plan.
Right.
Which I thought was really interesting. Very subtle.
It was very subtle, right? You didn't even think about it. When you finally got to the point where it was actually used, you almost didn't remember that it was even mentioned up front.
Yeah. And then when you did, you were like, oh, well, duh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you really did think about that. So I'm with you. I think that was something that was really well done. I also, there's a couple quick notes in here I had just in general about Peter David's writing style. I've never read Peter David before, which some people probably will be
really?
Like, you know, so this was my
Get
first
Get off this
foray.
Show, Matthew.
I know. Get off the shed. And so, but I love that he references the funniest things, like when D'Mara is talking to Maggie on the Enterprise B, and she says they're talking about singing gamblers, because she references Guys
line.
And Dolls.
Yeah.
She's like, well, it was the same era also that had shows about singing cats, a singing barber who killed people and turned them into meat pies. What can I tell you? It was an odd and perverse time.
I know, it's a great like, line.
It just made me think, though, that, like, would she really be referencing these things? Because, well, I mean,
maybe
that's like 300 years ago
yeah,
for her.
But remember that her father had this fascination with all of these ancient things. And so it wouldn't surprise me at all if he had exposed her to these musicals.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah. But it was just funny. This is
funny.
David really does seem to have a very lighthearted nature to his stories. I mean, there's some serious parts here, but really, at least this one, this is a full on adventure romp for a lot of it, and so he really plays that entire spirit well. And in some ways, made me think of this book a lot more in the genre of a TOS original series mm-hmm. era than necessarily movie era.
Yeah, it felt that way. I had to keep reminding myself yeah. that where we were on the timeline in the present day events in this book. Now, the book does jump around through time quite a bit, and but it did feel like an original series. TOS television series era story, very much. Talking about the humorous moments in here, Matthew, though, I early on in the book, I thought maybe this book should have been called Meet the Blumbergs, because
yes,
they go down to this planet where they receive the distress signal. They find this written language on something, and the officer Zon says none of the symbols were anything vaguely Terran. It corresponds to the known written language of an ancient, apparently long dead race called, and then tapers off, and then another officer Thompson says, called what? And then Zon says, the Blombergs. And Herrmann's like, say again? They're called what? The Blombergs, sir. The Blombergs? What kind of name for an alien race is that? It was too funny. But
it really
they're
is.
Named after the scientist who first discovered this dead civilization. So,
which is very, very funny. It definitely goes to show that Peter David has a great sense of humor. And so,
well, and in such a heavy story, it's great that he was able to insert these humorous moments.
Oh, yeah. It really does help for sure. And I think as we transition out of this section, you know, she is killed by Harriman, and the Excelsior is contacted, and they're both basically making their way back to Earth at this point. And the story jumps to give us the backstory on how Sulu meets the woman who's going to be his daughter's mother. So basically it's How I Met Your Mother
in space
Sulu style. Exactly. So, or should we say Indiana Sulu?
Indiana.
Because this felt just like an Indiana Jones episode.
It very,
you know?
Very much did.
In fact, it felt like the beginning of the Temple of Doom.
Yeah.
When they're in Hong Kong.
Yeah, yeah.
Very much like that.
Yeah. Section 2 definitely feels like Indiana Jones.
So the main, okay, this is the part that I wanted to ask you, Chris. The main setup is a city in the middle of the Sahara that's been created, and the whole city is created that it is a representation of old Earth, basically. The way everything worked then, this whole thing is basically a pleasure city for you to visit and really kind of immerse yourself in.
It's Ryza on Earth.
Except even more so in the sense that they're really recreating. It would be like visiting Williamsburg, but as a pleasure planet where anything goes. You can have all sorts of adventures. I mean, people actually go there in costume. It's like basically a cosplay Wonderland for the 23rd century.
Wow.
And I don't know about you, but this didn't fit at all with what I know about Star Trek and the future.
It was kind of weird, yeah, I'll admit. But it worked for me in the story. Just for the story, I didn't have any problem with it. But it did feel really weird that on Earth in the 23rd century that this place would exist and that it would be set up. It's something you would expect to find out in the backwaters of the Alpha Quadrant somewhere.
Yeah. So I think this section, as fun as it is, Sulu meeting this woman, Susan, having this rompous adventure, thinking he's being set up by Chekhov the whole time, just because Chekhov knows he wants to have some fun. This is set in between that time period where the Enterprise is being refit and the crew kind of doesn't have a lot to do as they're kind of waiting for that to happen. Mm-hmm. They're basically on leave because they've had their big, huge 5-year mission. And so they're getting to take all this leave now. And Sulu is bored. And Chekhov, which is the refrain you will hear often in this book, which is be careful what you wish for. Mm-hmm. You might get it.
That's an old Russian saying, Matthew.
Exactly. Exactly.
No, it's not. It's not. Chekhov admits it's Polish.
Which I thought was great that Chekhov's like, of course I know everything is not Russian. You know,
it's Polish.
I just
Slavic,
like to say it.
Yes.
Yeah. So I love that Sulu and Chekhov are the first gay couple in Star Trek going on vacation together. It's really cute.
But
so
of all the characters in this book, in the writing and in the voice, Chekhov was the most spot on of all. Don't you think? I thought Chekhov was just fantastically done. And the other characters were done well. But like with Sulu, like I had trouble actually hearing Sulu in Sulu's voice when I was reading the book. It just felt like this is a person delivering the lines that are needed for the story, but I didn't feel like the heart and soul of Sulu in it. But I did definitely feel Chekhov here. And not just because he writes it with the W and the V reverse and that stuff, but little things, the little expressions, like, oh, now you're the expert on this and that. You know, just it really felt like Chekhov.
Yeah, he does a really good job. In fact, this is the point where the story, you know, obviously set right after the 5-year mission, it definitely feels so much like that. It, mm-hmm. it feels like that kind of Chekhov, you know, because we don't get much Chekhov in the movies. And so we don't really kind of get a feel for what he's like then, how he's grown as a character. So this does feel so spot on. And, you know, circumstances happen. Sulu thinks he's a part of a huge game that's been created by Chekhov to help him have a good time. Yeah. And it turns out this is not a game. It's reality that he's caught in.
Did you?
Which was a nice twist.
Did you ever buy into it at all? Did you think at the beginning, did you think that maybe this was a setup by Chekhov?
No, I never bought that this was a setup.
Yeah, neither
so, again, I think to me, this is just really the weakest section of the book. It's fun, but I kind of was bored because I knew, I mean, the whole section, I just knew everything that was going to happen in it. There was no surprise.
But I think as the reader, we're not supposed to think it's a setup, though.
No, I don't think it's so, only, but it would have been.
But it stretches too long. Like, there's a point at which Sulu is still thinking it's a setup and like, wow, Chekhov, he really pulled out all the stops on this one. And I'm thinking, there's a gigantic guy holding a hot ember right in front of your face while you're tied to a chair and you think it's still part of a setup. And then even when Ling Sui or Susan Ling or whatever name, you know, she uses here and there crashes through the ceiling to rescue him, then he says, now I know it's a setup. I'm like, no, it's not. What makes you think Chekhov has the ability to pull this off?
Yeah, I mean, the elaborateness of it is just insane.
Yeah.
The only thing I really liked in this section, Chris, we do meet the mother. Mm-hmm. So, yes, How I Met Your Mother, Sulu edition. And a poor guy barely even remembers how they had sex. So,
well, the thing that tipped me off, though, was that initially when Chekhov and Sulu were sitting in the little cafe together, and the yellow umbrella was there. That really, I knew something was coming up.
Yep, exactly. A goat ran through, and there was a real pineapple, which I still don't know the answer to.
The blue French horn also tipped me off.
Yeah, that was when they mentioned that on the wall. Yeah. I was like, come on, stop ripping off, you know, How I Met Your Mother.
Yeah.
My favorite part here was just his nice nod to Casablanca, where he goes to the corner of Humphrey and Ricks.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I appreciated that he threw that in there for me as a huge Casablanca fan.
I also like when the bartender cannot understand what he's saying when he keeps asking for vodka. Yeah. Vodka.
Vodka.
And then he finally says, just give me a screwdriver. No orange juice. And then the bartender's
then the guy's like,
well, if I don't put orange juice in it, the only thing left will be, and then Chekhov's like, right.
Yeah, that was pretty funny. What I thought was interesting too is the section's called First Date. That's all that happens. They have like 2 days.
If you want to call that a date, I mean.
Yeah, exactly. I was a little, if that's Peter David's idea of a date, I don't know when I want to know what his idea of marriage is. Again, you know, he barely even remembers, honestly, that they had sex. And so it is a huge surprise, obviously, when this daughter does show mm-hmm. up. And so, strangely enough, you know, instead of going, you know, straight to, you know, the parenthood or finding out, you know, about the daughter, we go to the memorial service in the present. And
did you find it weird to structure the book that way? I actually think it was needed in order to break up the meeting of the mother and then the meeting of the daughter.
I thought it worked well. Yeah. And so I think it made sense to have the tiered structure where you have, you know, present, past, present, past, yeah. present. Yeah. I think that that worked very well. And obviously gave us a great outline. So thank you, Peter David. You had us in mind at Literary Trek.
Yeah,
so
we didn't even have to do an outline for today's show, did we?
Exactly. So I love this is a very short scene. It's only two chapters. Mm-hmm. You know, Harriman does a great job of memorializing Damora, and you can tell the pain that he's feeling, not only losing Kirk, but now another legend's daughter. The weight that he's feeling is just immense. I really feel sorry for this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then Chekhov kicks his ass, or at least tries to, and they get in this huge kerfuffle right after the memorial service. And I just thought, goodness, this poor Harriman, he cannot catch a break. I'm really hoping at this point when I'm reading the story, there's some redemption for him.
Yeah, and it comes at the very, very end, right? I mean, we get the Harriman exactly. that we're expecting for most of the book. And then at the end, finally, it's like he starts a recovery.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really just that he grows a pair and stands up to his dad, which, you know, in a lot of relationships just in real life, there's that time when you have to stand on your own.
Yeah.
And he really... He takes that, and this is again where for me I just really saw that jealousy that Blackjack has for that generation, mm-hmm. that crew that Harriman doesn't have,
mm-hmm.
and he's taken it so far that you know he's the one acting insane. He's yeah. the one being strangely mutinous and retarded in this story. It's not John.
Right. Do you think that could have played out the same if this admiral had not been his father, if it had been another admiral that was doing exactly the same thing but wasn't his father?
I think it could definitely have happened that way. I think it's more effective when it's his father, mm-hmm. who can also say to him, I'm the one who's been picking up for your lack of whatever for all these years.
But any admiral really could say that. Any admiral could say, like, you are my favorite officer and I've really been, you know, I got you your command
exactly.
and everything.
Exactly.
But something about it
that
father-son being
his father. Dynamic.
Yeah.
Yeah. It makes it sting all the more, I guess. And Chris, I think you could probably relate to this too. Just any son can. That time when a father might have said something they shouldn't have to you. Mm-hmm. It brings that home for any guy.
Yeah.
That feeling, because we all want to either live up to our dads or be better than them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's just the way it goes. You know, you either want to be your dad or you want to be better than him. So it's a good psychological conundrum for Harriman to be facing, to pull the reader in mm-hmm. to the psychology of the Harriman character and make him more dynamic mm-hmm. by the end of the story.
Yeah.
So I think that's the thing that I'm noticing, at least here in this story. Peter David excels in the psychology of the character, and kind of creating yeah. a rounded, fuller character than one you might know. So.
And I also did like how he handled Sulu in this short bit here at the memorial, where, I mean, you know, Sulu is extremely angry with Harriman. And Harriman, when he finally talks to Sulu before Chekhov goes after him, right? When he finally talks to Sulu, you know, Harriman is expecting great anger from Sulu, but Sulu controls himself and says, it's never easy to lose a crew member. You know, under circumstances like these, you did the best you could. It's all right. And of course, you know, and Harriman knows that it's not all right. And it's not all right with Sulu what happened, but I mean, Sulu showed the demeanor of a captain there, and I thought showed some compassion for Harriman.
Oh, definitely. I think that it was one of the best scenes for Sulu for me. The way that he's able to rise above, and think of Harriman as a man and a captain, mm-hmm. and how much of a struggle this. And to think too, I've got to think that Sulu is thinking to himself, put myself in Harriman's shoes. What would it be like to be responsible for the loss of, or feel the responsibility for the loss of Kirk, even though it's not his fault? Mm-hmm. And now my daughter, which for all we know, for everything that Starfleet has looked at, he did the only thing he could do. Making those life and death decisions is, you know, as Kirk would say, you want to sit in that chair, you know, that's what it means. And so I like it a lot.
One more little thing in this section that I also liked is we just talk about how Peter David calls back to different elements within Star Trek. I like the fact that he did drop in the line when they're trying to, you know, Uhura and everyone, they're trying to contact the former Enterprise crew members. They say, we weren't able to let Scotty know in time. We got a message out to the Janolan. It's transporting him to a retirement community at the Norpin colony. And I thought that was great just to place this in time, so that we know that this is somehow before the, it was whatever timeline, whatever year he was being transported. And we know that the Janolan crashes on the Dyson Sphere. And then in Relics in TNG, they pull him back. So it was just a nice little reference in there.
Yeah. And that's one thing I do want to mention, Kristen, and I was a little disappointed with something in this book as well. I did not like the way that the timeline was represented.
Mm.
There's not enough time in the movie era, I think. I think David plays it much more like it's only like 6 years of movie era time. It seems like instead of it being more like another 20 years, you know, that we know that Kirk and the Enterprise after the motion picture go on another 5-year mission. Mm. We also know they're sent out again after Star Trek V on another mission. So, and there's a lot more time.
Yeah, I agree with you on that.
And you don't get that sense of history through this movie era. It seems too compressed.
Yeah.
Like that they saved the whales and then,
well, that's the thing
they,
I was going,
you know, it,
I was,
yeah,
going to point out. Yeah, I do agree with you on that, because I did stop myself a number of times to think, okay, now this is where this falls on the timeline, because there is the scene where Damara, and it happened, this did happen a little bit too suddenly, right? Damara is having this conversation with her father after she had wandered into the Kobayashi Maru simulation at the academy by herself. And then they're having this conversation and it's not quite clear how much time passes. And then Sulu's gone. And then you realize that that's the moment where they stole the Enterprise. Like Janice Rand comes in and
right,
she's like, they stole the Enterprise. And Mara's like, they what? How do you steal a starship? And then she's in the apartment, or she's in, I guess it's an apartment, and there's the storm and the probe is there. And then she sees the bird of prey fly underneath the Golden Gate Bridge from her apartment window, which was really convenient. And yeah, it does feel like there's way too much. There are too many familiar events that we know happening in a time period that feels too compressed. That's definitely,
yeah,
true.
Exactly. And so that really does kind of move us into that fourth section of parenthood. And no, I'm not talking about the fantastic TV show with Monica Potter and Lauren Graham. I am talking about the finding out that you're a baby daddy, Sulu.
You're a baby daddy, Sulu.
Exactly. So this is really an interesting section, because we kind of learn, okay, Scotty says to Kirk, you know, in Generations, you know, you always say that if something is important, you make the time.
Right.
And this is the point of the story. I like this story overall, but this is not how I pictured Sulu having a kid. I really did picture the fact that Sulu actually had a real family. that he had gotten married, had a kid. He had made the time.
Yeah, that's what I thought too.
A child.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is fine, but it, honestly, still in my head canon, you know, since you go on what you have in the movies, the books are just there to fill in if you want them to. I kind of disregard this whole book just because of that.
Well,
I love the book. It's a great book,
yeah.
But I don't picture Sulu being a single dad. Like the way that Scotty made it sound was that he knew that Sulu had been a dad. You know, Kirk is just kind of too busy being a starship captain and saving the universe for him to pay attention to the fact that somebody in his crew might have a family like that.
Well,
but on the other hand, I
think it kind of works because Sulu's a single dad in this book, but he's a reluctant single dad and he really wants to get back out to the stars. But also when they say if something's important to you, you make the time. I think that it meshes with what Peter David did here because initially Sulu wants to send Amara to a boarding school in Washington. And so he can go out because he was going to be the first officer on the Bozeman. And obviously he wants to be a captain one day. And so being the first officer on the Bozeman would have been the next big step for him. Of course, it worked out well for him in the end, right? Because he got to be captain of the Excelsior, but
it, well, and also he didn't get in a time loop.
That's what I was saying. He didn't get caught in a time loop, but he realized that Damara was important to him. And so he made the time in his life to take care of her and raise her. And so I still think that it works, you know, because if something is important to you, you make the time for it. But I did, like you, always think that he probably got married. And in fact, when I started in on the book, because I had never read this book before, when I started in on the book, I was thinking, and even when it said part two for section two, first date, he was going to meet his wife. And they were going to actually get married. And, you know, I wasn't expecting the whole Indiana Jones one night stand thing. And then Damara showing up at his door 7 years later because her mother had been killed. I wasn't expecting that at all. But I can kind of reconcile it.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And I can too. I guess I just wanted to think better of Sulu. And it was interesting to watch him kind of deal with the idea of feeling honor bound because of the culture that he really holds on to, his Japanese heritage of doing what is right even if he doesn't want to, but that turns into something else. But that really in the beginning, it's him doing his duty. It's doing what is honorable. And so I think that's a really interesting thing. And watching him slowly mature into a father was interesting as well. Mm-hmm. It's so funny that, you know, Chekhov and him are talking at the beginning there. And he says, "I'm going to do what's right for her," Sulu said. "It's just that you and I might have different definitions about what is right." And Chekhov says, "Actually, I don't think we do. We simply and both won't admit it, that's all." And I think that, you know, it's really funny to watch Chekhov, who is the you know, confirmed bachelor as well, giving him parenting advice.
Well, Chekhov says only someone smart enough
to know about children knows not to have them, basically.
I think it's interesting how it mirrors Kirk a little bit, though, because the older Kirk of the films, you know, he has found out that he has a son. He's matured a lot. He's a lot more like a parental figure, more like a father figure than the TOS Kirk. And it's sort of the same thing that we see here within the confines of this book because of the time jumps that we have. The Sulu that we see at the very end of the book really has become that person as well.
Yeah, exactly. I agree with you. I think it does fit. It fits these characters well at this point. As she's growing up, they become closer. They start to grow closer, and then there's this thing that happens with them, where they have this fight, and she and her father are talking, and he says the completely wrong thing, which is he admits basically, "I took responsibility for you because it was the only honorable course to me."
Right.
And realizing that he's kind of really destroyed everything he'd built with her.
Yeah, well, she says, "I thought it was because you loved me." And then he said, "Exactly. It's both." But she doesn't believe him.
Yeah. Right. And it's at that point she says that she wants to join Starfleet just a couple of days later.
Well, it's not the first time she's mentioned it, but here, this is when it's like really serious, right? This is what she's going to do.
But I thought that was interesting too, because it's also the space where they start to grow apart, because, you know, she tells him later on, "Look, I resented you for staying with me, because I knew that your greatest destiny was to be on a starship and be doing these great things. And then when you did leave, I resented you for abandoning me." And so that this is the kind of the frustration of being a child, and growing up and, feeling like a burden at any point, is a very damaging thing for it.
Well, and it's also a challenge for a parent as well, to the balance between not making a child feel that way, but also teaching them responsibilities and that there has to be a framework to a relationship and to life as well. It's a really, really big challenge here. And I think that's where it shows with Sulu here, of the fact that Damara just shows up when she's 7 years old out of the blue, and he has to just kind of suddenly become a father. That balance is never easy for anyone as a parent. It's extremely difficult. He actually says in the book that, like, everyone wants to be the best parent they can be, but no one knows how, and I know less than most. And I think it's absolutely true. You know, you want to be the best parent, but there's nothing that can prepare you to be a parent. And that it plays out here anyway. It's a really difficult balance, and he obviously made that mistake in what he said to her, because, as he admitted, he's even less prepared than most people.
Right. And that leads us into that last section called Life After Death, where we've all known, obviously, that Damara is not dead. That's the point of the book. And so Sulu decides to go and do pretty much what Kirk did with the Enterprise, and basically steal a starship so that he can go to a forbidden zone and figure out what happened to his dead friend. So I think it's very interesting that this story, in some ways, Sulu is playing out the events of Star Trek.
Yeah.
You know, the end of Star Trek 2 and Star Trek 3, but in his own way.
Yeah, completely. And actually, that's something I wanted to ask you about. Did you feel that the story mirrored Kirk taking the Enterprise to the Genesis planet too much?
I don't think too much. I think it's good symmetry.
Okay.
I don't think it's overly blatant enough to where I'm just like, "Oh my God, seriously?" You know, it doesn't give you that feeling. So, I mean, you could definitely overbear this story with that. I think there's enough allusion to what's happening that this is kind of, you know, Sulu's moment of triumph, you know, like,
yeah,
his defiance of Starfleet to do what he knows is right for his friend, what his daughter.
I thought I thought that Peter David here skated a little bit close to maybe overdoing it, because the conversations with the admirals and the setting course, and, you know, this kind of, well, Sulu takes a little bit different tack to it, though. Like, he doesn't tell Chekov and Uhura what he's going to do, because he says, like, you know, if I let you know what I was going to do, then I know you'd try to come with me. So he does push them away. I guess maybe he remembers what Kirk did. And he's like, Kirk told us you don't need to come with me, but we had to do it. So I'm not even going to give them the option in this case.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think that they I think he skates the line. I think he skates close enough. But it doesn't ruin the story.
No,
for
it
me.
Doesn't. Yeah.
At all. I think if the second section here mm-hmm. doesn't ruin the story for me, this doesn't at all.
But the madman also has similarities to Khan as well in that he's wanting to get revenge, but it's a lighter version than
yeah. That. Yeah, it's a lighter version, and he also has a huge profit motive for what he's doing too, which is, we'll get into that real quick, is he is taking that amusement park technology of cloning and creating something, and they're trying to be able to create an army so they can sell clones. So basically, he's a cheap version of the Kaminoans from Star Wars.
That's what I was thinking the whole time I was reading it. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is funny because this is before the prequels came out. This is before the prequels came out. And so, you know, we hadn't heard of Kaminoans yet, but it really is like a very cheap version of what they do. And that's what he's trying to do because the Tholian assembly is very interested in buying the soldiers.
Well, it was just like it was like Star Wars, right? Like you said, we should flip it around. With Star Wars was like this because it did come later that the Tholians are going to build a clone army so that they can defeat the Federation.
Exactly, whoever they want. So I really liked though the end of this because basically I felt like this is the resolution between father and daughter and then father and son, the familial relationships that have been kind of driving the story. And I loved the line that she says, you know, I can't believe it takes us almost dying to have the conversation that we should have had a long time ago to say what we need to say. Apparently they just need to listen to more John Mayer. He tells you just need to say what you need to say. And then I really did like the resolution with Harriman and his dad. You know, I love the confrontation that they have where he says, feel free to court-martial me and bring everyone on the Excelsior up on charges too if you wish. Of course, full testimony will be offered. As it stands, a rescue mission overseen by one Admiral Harriman, aided and abetted by a captain of some renown who's credited with, among other things, saving the Kittimer Conference, not to mention the entire Earth. And then, of course, going on that, you know, this, we got our crewmen back. We also found out there was this whole illegal use of alien technology that the Tholians really wanted. So, I don't really know what you're going to do about that, Dad. Suck it.
Right. He gives him an option. He says, we can tell things how they also happened that you and Admiral were ready to fire on a defenseless Federation starship.
Right. Gotta say, not a bad card play there, Harriman. Not a bad card play, Junior. Me basically outwitted his dad, which I loved.
And Captain John Harriman did what all of us have so often wanted captains to do. When you have the Admiral or the Galactic High Commissioner or whoever it is on the bridge disturbing your mission, his dad, the Admiral, sits down in the command chair, won't move, won't leave the bridge, wants to blow up the Excelsior. So what does Harriman do? He calls down and he has them beam the Admiral out of the captain's chair directly into the brig.
That was
best
awesome.
Move ever.
I am gonna beam your ass into the brig. That was fantastic. That's one of the best scenes in this book. It really does a great job, I think, in the end of wrapping up the storylines that we've been talking about. and giving a real sense of finality to the story that's been happening, as well as, I think, to me, and I'm really hoping to see this as we move with Harriman now. We're going to be talking, Chris, about Harriman later on in Insertments Among the Ruins, and then we'll talk about it in One Constant Star. So I'm really hoping that they'll pick up on this ending for Harriman and kind of this, okay, this man's grown a pair. He's a man who can be a captain in the vein of somebody like a Sulu, like a Kirk. You know, give us somebody like that. So I'm hoping that that continues and we don't get more of the kind of wishy-washy Harriman that, you know, we kind of get used to in so many of the things we see in literature. Mm-hmm. So I think, I guess, I don't know, if I were to rate this, Chris, I'd probably give it 7 out of 10 command chair beamings.
Excellent.
Yeah. So what about you, Chris? What would you give as a rating and final thoughts there?
Yeah, I really enjoyed the book as well. I think it did a really good job of filling in that backstory about Demora. It has great character growth for Sulu over time as we jump through the time periods. And I think for the most part, Peter David did a good job of writing a backstory to what we saw in Generations so that it actually makes sense. You know, whether it's what you thought it was or not, and I think in most cases it's not what you were thinking it was going to be, I think it still fits in pretty well. I think I would give it 7 screwdrivers without the orange juice, which would be like, you know, like you order a virgin pina colada, for example, that has no rum in it. This would be the exact opposite right. of that, right? It's only the alcohol.
Oh, I think that's a fantastic idea, personally. More alcohol for everyone.
All right. Well, Matthew, I'm glad we talked about this book. It was definitely good for me to prepare for One Constant Star when it comes out, because I, as I said earlier, had not actually read The Captain's Daughter in the past. And hopefully it was helpful for our listeners as well. But it's not the only thing we've been talking about here on the network this past week. So here, everyone, are some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Dr. McCoy with Larry Nemechek.
But, you know, when everybody else had their Kirk shirt or their Spock shirt, like the first uniform I had my mom make me was a McCoy uniform, of course.
Earl Grey.
The 7-7 Challenge.
Did you know that Tim Russ was one of the possible choices for Commander Geordi LaForge?
But did you know he was also in Star Trek Generations?
But did you know he was also served with Captain Sulu on board the Excelsior?
I did know that, in fact.
The Orb.
Our Man Bashir commentary.
I love Avery.
Tell me what happens next.
And the look up at an angle. He's not even looking at Bashir, he's looking up at the angle. Tell me what happens next.
The Ready Room.
Spectre of the Gun.
They're so quick to jump to conclusions, like the guy gets shot in front of them and they're like, death is the only thing that's real on this planet. And like, wait a minute, how do you know that? That could just be a total figment of your imagination as well.
To the journey!
Favorite Sun commentary.
Yeah, Janeway is... you better get more coffee, sweetie. It's going to be a long day. Ensign Kim is going to put you through some hell.
Warp 5.
Alternate outcomes of the Zindi crisis.
But the Enterprise is heavily damaged. We're talking practically destroyed. Everything but a shell. Maybe the saucer section is the only thing that's still around. And 80% of the crew dies. Commentary, Trek Stars.
Rick Berman and Star Trek.
He's kind of a moving target, so he found some dimensionality. He made it into a cube.
Yeah.
And so he was able to move things around in there.
A Borg cube.
Continuing mission.
Star Trek Equinox.
John Savage actually came up with the premise for the story, but they needed somebody to flesh it out, to develop it. And so they sent me John's premise, and I just, well, it expanded into the script for the project that we're doing.
Melodic Treks.
the Borg in music.
In when they released it as a Blu-ray,
and they combined them.
They connected them, and there's the no feature. Delay. There's they cut off that music, and then it's just like, oh, that didn't work.
Literary Treks.
Rise of the Federation, Tower of Babel.
Saval talks about this idea that, you know, people mutually consent to abide by these rules for their collective benefit. The idea that, you know, absolute unfettered freedom is just a ridiculous idea.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and get in on our daily Trek Talk. We have new Trek Talk for you every day of the week, and some days we even have two shows for you. And you'll find them in a wide variety of places, including on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune, or you can download or stream from our website. So go grab the shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. Well, if you'd like to share your thoughts with us on the Captain's Daughter or anything else we talked about in news today, maybe you want to tell us what you think about Q being in the Abramsverse, you can do that in a number of ways. You can go to our website at trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose Literary Treks, and that will come to both Matthew and me by email. You can also send us a voicemail through the website, or you can go to our forums at trek.fm/forums to talk to us and other listeners about this show, Star Trek books, comics, TV series, anything you want to discuss about Star Trek, you can do it over there. And if social media is your thing, you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, and you can find us on Twitter, where we're always tweeting away about Star Trek, under username trekfm. Now, Matthew, when you're not, hanging out in a replica of Casablanca, trying to see if you can pick up a mysterious woman, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. You can also find me doing The Orb with you, where we talk about all things Deep Space Nine. So if you want to know what we might think of a JJ verse Deep Space Nine, maybe that's a good topic for
us. That would be
Chris.
An interesting topic, wouldn't it?
Hmm. Yeah. So anyway, you can find us there. And then, of course, I have my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Now, Chris, when we are not sitting around the Reprimand just desirously looking at a plate of chocolate mousse and whether or not you should actually plunge in for that succulent bite, where can we find you?
Well, you know, I like to know if it's good or not first, so I like to invite Troy over and let her show me how to eat it.
That's probably a good plan.
Riker told me.
Well, and then by the time she's done, there isn't any left, so you'd even get to try it.
Well, no, I order two, so I got to take care of it.
Oh, that's wise. You know. Yeah, that's smart. Don't let her see that second one, though, Chris. You'll never get a bite in edgewise. So.
I know. I keep ordering over and over and over and over, and then I say, you know, I've never seen anyone eat 10 chocolate mousses before.
She's going to need a lot more workout sessions with Dr. Crusher.
Yeah.
That's going to be the case.
And that'd be A-okay with you, right?
With Dr. Crusher, yeah. For sure.
All right. Well, yeah, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username, as well as on my personal website at cbrianjones.com. And then elsewhere on the network, besides doing The Orb with Matthew, you can find me on Warp 5, where we talk exclusively about Enterprise. You can also find me on MatterStream, which is about science and social issues and topics like that. You can find me on Continuing Mission, which is all about independent films and productions like Star Trek Continues, Axanar, Renegades, and such. And then you can find me every week on The Ready Room with hosts from all around the network and special guests as we talk about Star Trek news and all 5 live-action Star Trek series. So check out those shows and see what we're talking about over there. Before we let you go, we'd also like to remind you about our sponsor for today's show, Audible.com, the best source for audiobooks that you'll find anywhere. Go pick up Peter David's New Frontier books or any other book that you like, and get that book absolutely free as a Trek FM listener just for trying Audible. Go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. If you decide at the end of the trial not to stick with Audible, there's nothing to lose because you get to keep that audiobook. But I know you're going to love Audible and you're going to want to stick with it. So again, try it at audibletrial.com/trekfm. By doing so, you'll be helping us keep Literary Treks coming to you every week. And we really thank Audible for their support of the show and the network.
Thank you so much for joining us. And until next time, live long and read on.
What do you call that, light reading?
To each his own, number one.
Finding out that you're got a baby, you're a baby daddy, Sulu.
You're a baby daddy, Sulu.
Exactly. Wait, that might be the title of the episode.
I think we just named the show.
You're a baby daddy, Sulu.
Oh man,
that's the best Literary Trek title ever. Oh my god!
All right.
Oh man, you should put this at the end as a stinger.
Definitely.
Oh, okay.